So we're going to go to case three. Pretty common situation, unfortunately. This patient is another patient of Dr. Fishkin. The woman actually is a physical therapist, young woman. She's 49 years old, and when she presented, she was premenopausal. This is in 2001. She has an ER-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative tumor, gets AC, the old TC. And then just as she's finishing her fifth year of tamoxifen, comes in with back pain and is found to have metastatic disease to the bone. At this point, she is found to be postmenopausal. She gets palliative radiation therapy. However, on the letrozole, she has rapid disease progression, doing poorly. And he actually puts her on a trial that Edith Perez subsequently published, a phase two study looking at bevacizumab docetaxel and capecitabine. She actually has a very good response to treatment, but a lot of problems with the docetaxel. So the docetaxel stops, she continues on capecitabine, and bevacizumab actually gets out to a year and does pretty well. And has progressive disease, more radiation therapy, and then he goes back to hormonal therapy. Lady gets fulvestrant, and she's still on fulvestrant more than 3 years later. Here's Dr. Fishkin and the patient.
She's very friendly, very straightforward, kind of what you would expect for a person who works as a therapist. You know, very easygoing, easy to work with, very friendly, very outgoing. You know, even my nurses know her because they call her and refer her patients for lymphedema therapy. She seems a little shocked that she's done this well. You know, when you work in this area, you don't expect to see patients with metastatic breast cancer alive and free of disease this many years later. And she's now, you know, only in her early 50s, feeling well, working full time.
Let's talk a little bit about her clinical course. What happened after you first treated her with letrozole for Mets?
Her tumor got worse on her MRI, and that's when we offered her one of our NCCTG trials, and that gave bevacizumab, capecitabine, and docetaxel. Now, this was shortly after the ECOG had presented its data, and so we were very enthusiastic about trying to get patients bevacizumab, and there really wasn't any way to get insurance to cover it at that time, and I said, well, that's a great idea. You know, I was really enthusiastic about her going on the trial, and she went on that and just had horrible mucositis and difficulty with her treatment. She eventually got tapered down and then finally, you know, came off of therapy because her disease just basically stabilized.
Any questions you'd like to see the faculty address in terms of fulvestrant?
Yeah, she's been on fulvestrant a pretty long time. This is my very longest patient on fulvestrant now. We've changed the dosing per the recent study, so I think she started off with the 250 and now she's up to 500. But is there a dose response curve on this drug? And, you know, what's the appropriate way? If you've got a patient on the lower dose, should you switch them to the higher dose?
Okay, well, let's get to some quick practical stuff. First, dose of fulvestrant. Eric, what about the pragmatics? We actually asked the audience. Of course, there are reimbursement issues. We know lots of international people here tonight, so there are all kinds of practical issues. But we said, in general, what dose do you try to use? Looks like 2/3, 500. Eric, what dose do you try to use? And will you switch somebody who's on 250 to 500?
Yeah, so since the FDA approval of the higher dose, typically we at our place tend to use 500 milligrams. If someone were doing well on 250 and had been on it for a long time, I don't think I would change them.
Cliff, what about this issue of combining anti-angiogenic therapy, specifically Bev and hormone therapy? Dr. Trena at your place has looked at that in terms of safety. Where do you think that's heading?
Well, Tiffany Trena did that as a fellow with Moore Dickler, and that is the pilot study for the CLGB trial that Skip cited. There is really interesting preclinical data that highlights the angiogenic effect of estrogens, and you see it play out in the uterus on a monthly basis for younger women. And Rakesh Jain has shown very nicely a second wave of angiogenesis in hormone refractory breast cancer models. So all of that led us to look at the combination. Where it's heading, frankly, is going to be determined in large part by Moore's CLGB trial. If we get a significant benefit there, enough to justify, I have to add, the additional burden and toxicity of giving bevacizumab to a group of patients who are otherwise enjoying a relatively toxicity-free treatment period, then I think we may be onto something. As an aside, one component of the Michelangelo Foundation's trial of sorafenib involves letrozole with or without sorafenib as well. So I think there's going to be a little more data in there in the next couple of years.
Interesting. Skip?
Just a quick comment. I echo Cliff's points about the fact that the phase 3 trials are ongoing and we need the results. I think we often think of some of these hormonal trials that we would put a patient on who would have ordinarily gotten hormonal therapy and then, you know, the bevacizumab would be added in the study. In fact, if you look at the experience of the patients on the Sarah Cannon trial, and certainly my experience, it's tended to be patients that went on that study who we would have considered for chemotherapy in some of those, and yet they had relapsed quickly after adjuvant chemotherapy with aggressive disease, and two of my patients, frankly, refusing more chemotherapy after the rapid relapse, and then had nice responses to hormonal therapy and bevacizumab. So very anecdotal, and I say that more in support of getting the randomized phase 3 trials done, but there probably really is some activity there.
I do want to just say one of the disappointments, and I'll use that word, that we've experienced with the turmoil over the approval of the drug is many, many unfortunately confused investigators and maybe IRBs asking us about the validity of continuing that CLGB trial in the face of the FDA uncertainty. And I just have to say the two things, of course, have nothing at all to do with each other.
Let's get into the simple issue of bevacizumab. I'm saying that, you know, it is complicated. I want to focus more on the clinical science. We could spend the whole night in the next 2 days talking about cost and reimbursement and our financial crisis, but just risk-benefit of treatment. So we asked the audience, Eric, putting those things aside, are there situations where you'd like to use bevacizumab in patients with metastatic breast cancer? And there's kind of an interesting split here. About 58% of the audience see a role for it, either generally or more specifically on a response is needed. How would you answer that question, Eric?
I tend to view bevacizumab similar to the way that I view combination chemotherapy, which is that generally speaking, giving combination therapy versus giving a single agent doesn't result in an improvement in survival compared to giving sequential single agents. But it leads to perhaps a more rapid response and a longer time to progression. So in a patient who's quite symptomatic, in whom I would like to maximize the chance of having a response and keeping that disease under control for as long as possible, placing cost reimbursement and regulatory issues aside, I would tend to give paclitaxel and bevacizumab. I don't, however, feel that it is a regimen that has to be given to every patient that walks in the door. And I think we have to keep in mind that it is not a regimen, very clearly, that is going to make somebody live longer. And so you have to really balance the side effects and risks versus the potential benefits.
Mark?
I'm really concerned about all of the data that's coming in, you know, recently on the VEGF axis. And if you look at Avada, the results by the PI were described to be statistically significant yet clinically irrelevant. The Ribbon 1 data I found to be uninspiring because of a very modest increase in PFS. Ribbon 2, similar kind of findings, modest shifts, certainly measurable, you know, effects, but not revolutionary in terms of changing practice patterns, in my opinion. Add to that all of the TKIs, which were argued to perhaps be even better than a ligand-directed antibody because they hit all three VEGF receptor kinases. And yet, we see that two of the sunitinib trials were closed early due to futility, and the sorafenib trials, the first-line trial with paclitaxel, is not even being pursued in phase 3. The sorafenib trial also had very modest gains in randomized phase 2 that is being followed up with a randomized phase 3, but I don't see how we can reach any other conclusion with the whole body of data taken together that perturbation of the VEGF axis in breast cancer yields measurable but modest clinical effects at best. Angiogenesis is clearly important in my view, and there must be other factors other than VEGF that are directing that, and that's where the field needs to move next.
So what if I say, Mark, we just need the HER2 for Bev or angiogenesis, and if we had that, then it would make sense?
Well, I mean, there are two spaces where, you know, Bev could be resurrected, and that is with the endocrine combinations, and then the other is in combination with HER2 targeted agents. At least with HER2 targeted agents, there's some rationale because we published data in a very large clinical cohort demonstrating very clearly that there is a marked increase in VEGF expression, intratumoral, you know, tumor synthesized VEGF in HER2 positive breast cancer compared to HER2 negative. So at least there's some rationale in that setting, and we'll see what happens. Luca Gianni has a randomized phase 3 trial in the metastatic setting looking at Bev trastuzumab combinations with chemotherapy, and that will certainly be telling. I think tomorrow at this meeting, we're also going to see a randomized phase 2 trial of a Bev-trastuzumab chemo combination as well that looks intriguing.
So final comment from Eric. What I meant to say was HER2 in terms of a test. In other words, if we could find the people within the entire group who benefit more, I mean, if we didn't have HER2 and we'd use trastuzumab on everybody, we would have seen not too much.
Right. So actually, I was going to go there myself. So I think the third way to resurrect bevacizumab is if we can find a good predictor. Because, you know, in the midst of all of these patients who have HER2 negative disease where it's been given with chemotherapy, there are probably a small to moderate number who actually get a real benefit. And until we can figure out who they are, we really have a problem. But if we can figure out who they are, then we potentially have a significant benefit for some people.
So we're going to go back to HER2 as a discussion point now, metastatic disease. Skip, you wanted to make a final point.
No, I would agree with what everybody's said. And it's interesting, if you look at the bias for distribution in the trials, some of the patients getting randomized to the VEGF trials are triple negative because of the lack of therapy. And yet, I think with the ER-positive combination, we've seen encouraging data. With the HER2-positive, we've seen encouraging data. And yet, the skewed patient being accrued to the bevacizumab trial study have been triple negative, and we're not clear that that makes a difference there. So, you know, those are all just part of the factors.